case, Vaughn v. Vilsack. Mr. Whitney?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. This case presents two central issues. The first is that where a plaintiff makes three claims for relief and the defendant only challenges one of them on a motion for summary judgment, and the court doesn't even mention the other two claims, is it not reversible error for the court to grant summary judgment with respect to the entire case? The second issue we're raising on this appeal is, in a Title VII retaliation case, could a reasonable jury conclude that the employer's reasons for adverse employment actions were a pretext for retaliation, where the first such action was taken 2 days after the predicate EEO matter was settled, the employer conducted no investigation of the alleged misconduct by the plaintiff, and there were additional indicia of retaliation. For example, management refused to even acknowledge other proposals to resolve the workplace conflict at issue, provided shifting explanations for denying plaintiff overtime, and even went to the lengths of creating an entirely new department in the workplace in which it placed only the plaintiff and one other individual who had filed a recent EEO complaint. On both of these issues, we're here on de novo review because it's motion for summary judgment. The grounds for reversal on both issues are compelling, I would submit to the court. The first issue has been conceded by the defendant. It's not even touched in his brief, except in a very indirect way where he does mention it, but only in passing, in attempting to argue that the denial of overtime and the failure to allow my client into the GS-11 position on a detail were not materially adverse employment actions, which I would submit is it clearly has no merit. Obviously, if you're denied positions or denied overtime, you're losing pay. That's clearly a materially adverse employment action. So I don't think that we need to spend a great deal of time on the first issue, where it has essentially been conceded. On the second issue, Your Honors, the thing I would like to emphasize is that both the decision of the court below and in defendant's argument before this court, there is a repeated assertion that, well, the defendant had to take the action he took because my client was harassing this other employee, and obviously there is a duty for the employer to deal with the harassment. But conspicuous by its absence throughout this entire case is the production of any evidence whatsoever that the plaintiff was harassing this coworker, Towery, in 2006-2007, the relevant period, other than her affidavit, that's the only evidence presented before the court and before this court, claiming that he was calling and emailing her a lot on the job. And even she doesn't claim in that affidavit that those contacts weren't work-related. As a matter of fact, in August 2006, a very short period before she submits this complaint, she even got my client, the plaintiff, in trouble on the grounds that he was not contacting her enough. He wasn't communicating with her enough. The other thing in this regard with respect to this presumption that both the court and defendant makes that he was harassing her during this period is that there was zero investigation of this. My client was never even told, never even notified beforehand that these new allegations of harassment were being made. He was never told specifics. He was never given an opportunity to tell his side of the story. Now, I realized there was one affidavit by the center director, the very person against which my plaintiff had the prior EEO activity, in which he said he received complaints from others or statements from others that this harassment was going on. We're never told any specifics. It was never produced to the court. There was never another affidavit by a single coworker to verify this. I think a reasonable jury could conclude there was no investigation. And as this court has held in the Hall v. Bodine case, where there's evidence of a sham investigation, a reasonable jury could conclude from that that that's evidence of pretext. If an employer doesn't even go through, you know, goes through the motions but doesn't conduct a serious investigation of allegations like this, that could be evidence of pretext. Here, we don't even have a sham investigation. We have zero investigation. Accordingly, I would submit to the court that a logical conclusion, if a sham investigation could be sufficient to show pretext, certainly zero investigation could be sufficient to show pretext. Another point to make with regard to the second issue is the timing. And I realize there's debate on both sides on this case about timing alone. Suspicious timing alone is not enough, typically, to sustain a retaliation claim. But in some of its decisions, and it's cited in my brief, there could be exceptions to that rule where the timing is very, very close. And in this case, I would call the court's attention to the time sequence here. On August 16, 2007, plaintiff reaches a settlement agreement, a mediated settlement agreement on his prior EEO claim. On August 23, 2007, coworker Towery signs her EEO agreement resolving the harassment issue, in which part of the settlement agreement is that my client is supposedly not able to work, is not able to work the same hours when she's working. September 11, 2007, my client signs the agreement resolving his EEO complaint. And then on September 13th, 2 days later, he gets a letter of direction telling him, oh, you have to now work completely different hours that are going to make it impossible, virtually impossible, to do your job. 2 days later, if there ever was a case where the suspicious timing alone might support a claim of retaliation, might show the pretext, this would be the poster child case for that. I don't think you could get much of a closer nexus than we have in this case. Accordingly, I believe it was error for the court below not to give due consideration to that, that a reasonable jury could certainly conclude from all the facts presented that the reason given for these adverse employment actions were indeed pretextual, and retaliation was the real reason for it.
So it seems that what you want us to do is just sort of ignore the whole 2 year history, the prior history, the order of protection that was issued, like all of those things. You don't think the employer could look at all that and put in context and try to decide whether they had to do a full-blown investigation or whether they were at that point there had been enough in terms of this situation?
I would know. Of course, I'm not suggesting that should be ignored. But the order of protection never mentioned workplace harassment. The order of protection exempted from the no-contact order the workplace. The state court obviously wasn't overly concerned with there being a workplace problem. And that was in 2005. We're now moving ahead to 2006-2007. The order of protection expires in 2007. These are completely new allegations. And that's not even getting into some of the other affidavits that we presented, including one by an employee who said that he heard Towery say that she would do whatever it took to get my client fired. So when you look at all this, there should have been some investigation of this. Here, there was none. Your Honors, I see I'm into my rebuttal time. I'd like to reserve a little bit for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Moore.
Good Thank you, if it pleases the court. My brother counsel, Mr. Whitney. I am frankly astounded at the assertion that there was no investigation. We know that management was intimately involved from day one with the ongoing harassment, which went over a number of years, which became so serious that this woman had to go to the Circuit Court of Saline County to get an order of protection under the Domestic Violence Act. We know that there was a full-blown adversary hearing at which the plaintiff was represented by counsel, as was Ms. Towery, represented at counsel for a determination of whether or not the plaintiff was in fact an abuser under the Illinois Domestic Violence Act. And we know that he was found to have been an abuser under the Illinois Domestic Violence Act. Ms. Towery advises management of what's going on. She advises early on, and the first thing that they do is that they say, let's remove him from the workplace and let's find out if he's fit for employment. And he agrees that he will undergo a mental evaluation. And he submits himself to Dr. Roger Lyons, who submits a report which says that he has a narcissistic personality. He can't appreciate what he's doing in relation to his coworkers. We know that coworkers have come to management and said that they have had to physically interpose themselves to avoid further abuse by this plaintiff with Ms. Towery at the workplace. We know that things get to the point where they say, no more contact at all. You're out of here for purposes of any involvement with Ms. Towery, and they change his work hours. Now, they do that after things have gotten so bad that Ms. Towery has had to submit a formal complaint to EEO alleging sexual harassment based on gender because this man is harassing her and stalking her and has abused her, and she has suffered physical abuse. Now, what has happened is that over this period of years, the plaintiff has put the management in a catch-22 position. She has a formal complaint. There is, to say there's no investigation ignores the fact that there are multiple meetings with both Ms. Towery and with the plaintiff and management. There are multiple memos about that. There is a complete EEO investigation. In fact, there are a good number of affidavits from the EEO investigation, which are part of the record. Exhibits 12, 15, and 16 are all affidavits out of the EEO investigation. So there's an exhaustive investigation, which results in the management, the Department of Agriculture, having to arrange so that there is going to be no contact whatsoever between the abuser and the fellow employee. The employer's got an obligation to provide a safe workplace. The employer has gone through progressive discipline, has done what it can do. They didn't fire him, and although, as I dropped a footnote in my brief, as soon as Ms. Towery retired, he was, in fact, returned to his former position. So to say that there was no investigation simply ignores the sum and substance of the fact. And to say that there are three separate instances of retaliation, I think, really raises a semantic issue. There is one retaliation. It has three manifestations: the overtime, the separation, and the failure to detail. The failure to detail, well, let me suggest that the record shows that this plaintiff is hardly the kind of person that you want to promote, given his record with his co-workers. So there's a completely separate and legitimate reason not to detail him over and above any retaliation. Then to say that that he doesn't get any overtime, well, I don't believe that there's anything in the record that says that anybody at the Department of Agriculture employment site at the Golconda Forest Service got any overtime at all. I don't think anybody got any overtime, and I don't think there's anything in the record that says anybody got overtime. If there's no overtime offered, that's a non-issue. And I think when you take the facts as a whole, you can see that the employer is in a position where, really, the employer had two choices. One, try and work this out in an equitable manner and provide a safe workplace, or to dismiss the employee. For whatever reason, they chose not to fire Mr. Vaughn. They kept him on. As far as I know, he's still working at the Employment Service, although Ms. Tower Reid is gone. Under the circumstances, Judge Steele's order is perfectly proper. I would encourage the court to affirm. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer. Otherwise, I've got nothing to say.
Thank you. Mr. Moore. Mr. Whitney.
Thank you, Your Honors. On his presentation, counsel once again resorts to the same kind of begging the question we've seen repeatedly in this case. He says, well, Ms. Towery had to submit a formal complaint to EEO. How do we know she had to unless we know that there was new harassment going on? We don't know this. Defendant could have resolved this simply. If there was a single other coworker who had observed this, he could have included it in his motion for summary judgment. It is conspicuous by his absence. He refers to multiple meetings that were held to try to resolve that. That was in 2005-2006. These matters had been resolved. This came as a new bolt from the blue in 2007 when this new work situation was imposed on him. I would also point out that the work schedule was far more adverse than it had to be. I'm sorry, I see that my time has expired.
Leave that thought.
Well, in that my client made an offer of compromise to management saying, well, how about I get to at least, you know, show up during normal business hours 2 days a week or some compromise, and she could work other days a week so we can both do our job adequately. Management never even responded to that proposal.
What about this overtime issue, Mr. Whitney?
We did present evidence that there was overtime. It was in plaintiff's affidavit, and it was in the affidavit of Mr. Hayden, Brooks Hayden. I think it's Exhibit 24. There was overtime offered. He was denied it. He was first in seniority.
All right. Thank you, and thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.